Hey, this is the JR. Are you talking to me? And, you know, I don't see anyone else here but Jude Fox. Jude, are you talking to me tonight?
I am going to be taking a pogo stick straight down to you all night long.
Okay, so I'll try to figure that one out later. Anyway, it's Jude Fox. I'm Rob Law. And Rowan, he's not going to be here tonight. As you know, he was having some problems. One with his pet cat, who's really okay. He's fine, but he also had some romantic problems. It turns out he just decided to move in with O'Leary. And Rowan's got, like, no possessions. He's got, you know, he's got his old Tolkien books that he loves, but they're just like paperbacks. He doesn't even care. He's got his laptop. He's got, like, some chairs, some, you know, whatever. So he doesn't have a lot of stuff. So what happened was O'Leary gets to his apartment, and she's like, "Wait, that's way too much stuff." And he's like, "What? What do you mean?" She's like, "I can't do this." And she leaves, and he follows her, and she basically had called it off, and he follows her to the apartment to see if he can talk it out. And he gets there, and the thing is, she turns out to be a hoarder. She's got, like, a ton of stuff. So he just turned around and went back home with his, like, crate of stuff. But he's not going to be here tonight. But we did get his notes. We got the Great Wave. Jude, what do you think about the Great Wave?
I think that it was pretty great. It came in just gushing with water and overtaking Numenor in a vision that started the show, and it was spectacular.
All right. I love this episode. This is my favorite by far so far.
Same here.
And I love Adar. Cold Hands, he's awesome. So let's go through it. Let's go through the play-by-play. And we cut to Numenor, and it's Muriel's. She's having a baby naming ceremony in this great hall, and the hall is open, facing the open air of the Numenorean shore. And she's doing this baby naming ceremony, and she says, "May Numenor's strength arise in thee, her wisdom guide thy steps." And just as she says that, Nimloth, the tree, the white tree, starts, the leaves start shedding all over the place, and they're blowing all over the place, and we get this tidal wave, and it crashes in, and it destroys Numenor and hits her while she's holding the baby. And then we find that Muriel is sitting up in a chair, and she's having a vision. She's awake. It's not a dream. And her servant lady comes in and says it's a perfect day. Jude, what do you think about that?
As I said, I think that the opening was one of the most spectacular things we've seen on the show so far. It's clearly a story-wise just setting up a whole lot of what some of us know is to come for poor Numenor. And I really don't think I've got a bad thing to say about that opening. It was breathtaking.
Agreed. But I thought it was very interesting that she was talking about Numenor's strength arise in thee, her wisdom guide thy steps, which she's saying to the baby in this ceremony. And it seems like a good message for her. That's what I remember thinking. And that if she doesn't really find her wisdom, that Numenor is going to be destroyed, and we're going to see more about that later in the lesson, in the episode, in the lesson. So now we go to our next scene, and we've got Tamar. Tamar is the guy that Halbrand kicked his ass in the last one. He's that lead guy who he stole the guild crest from. And he's rabble-rousing in the street. He is just throwing shade at Muriel for being an elf lover and he's getting the crowd to chant, "Elf lover, elf lover," and he's saying all kinds of stuff. And he's, "They're going to take our jobs, those elves. They don't sleep, they don't get tired, they're going to take our jobs."
Well, what do you think the Numenorean equivalent of a rebel flag would be? Because I'm pretty sure they've got it somewhere there.
Oh, yeah. Make Numenor great again, baby. So, this dude who we're going to later find his name, Kemen, he goes and tells Farazon. Now, Farazon is just working the public. He is shaking hands. He's kissing babies. He's like, "Bro, I'll see you next weekend." He's just really like being a politician. And this dude, Kemen, comes up to him and says that there's a squall building up in the town square. And he gets there, and he hears Tamar and the elf lover stuff, and he really, like, shows Tamar how to work a crowd. He just, first of all, he's like, "First of all, I'm Farazon. Look at my hair. Look at my my lion mane. You mewling little bitches, scared of one little elf." And then he goes into this speech about how their ancestors killed Morgoth, and they built the best city, the best civilization the world's ever known, and now one little elf's got him scared? And he just takes over the crowd, and he says, you know, as long as he's alive, he's never going to let elves take over Numenor. No, no, but he really makes them feel proud. And again, it's like, you know, make Numenor great again. Trust in me. Trust in Farazon. But you notice that he does not defend the queen. Says nothing about, don't say that she's an elf lover or anything like that. It's just all about him. And they're chanting his name, and he buys everyone a fucking drink. So he's obviously angling for power. What do you think, Jude?
Well, I've got a few things to say about that particular scene because it struck me in an interesting way. Number one, something you didn't mention is that Kemen, by the way, the name Kemen, almost George R. R. Martin territory where it's like, it's supposed to be Kevin, but we're going to change one letter and just mess with you a little bit. Mm. Anyway, Kemen is actually Farazon's son. And I think that'll come into play throughout the episode.
Is he definitely? Because Farazon...
Oh, yes, he tells him when they first they're first speaking. He's like, "Listen, son.
I
would rather you be this than that," because he's, you know, trying to impress his father, and his father is not impressed. He's like, "I would rather have a son that's how did he phrase it? Wise than clever," I believe is what he said.
Right, so, right. I wasn't sure if it was actually his son, if he was just saying son.
I'm not really sure if he's a show-only character. I kind of think he is. I don't recall him having a child in the books, but that's irrelevant right now.
So it's building a theme, because more characters are going to express that later.
Yeah, we definitely have this theme of family that's building through the whole show, and I think that's why it's important that he's related, and especially where he's going to be going throughout this episode, Kemen. I'm finding that very interesting, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. Anyway,
speaking of which, Kemen is now he's kind of chatting up Ayari, and he sees her in the street, and he is first of all, you know, Ayari's impressed with Farazon, but Kemen says Farazon, his speech, I find it infuriating, actually. And then he's talking her up, and he tries to give her a little bit of wine. He's like, "Hey, you want a little of the wine?" It doesn't hardly has any roofies in it. my name is Kemen. Kemen, your buttocks. Oh, sorry. I made a dirty joke. I'm sorry, people. It was low hanging fruit.
Well,
did you want to say something before, Jude? You had your little finger up.
I did want to say something before because I think the back and forth with the crowd and Farazon coming and sort of settling them down but feeding into their propaganda at the same time is kind of interesting. And then the way he calls out for drinks all of a sudden, it almost feels to me, watching that scene several times, that perhaps the entire scene was staged, that perhaps he had set this into motion in order to be the man that calms them down, in order to ingratiate himself into the crowd in that manner. And on top of that, it, something that really makes you see who he is when he speaks about the Guild Crest little badges, and then he talks about the calluses on his hands, and he holds his hands up, and we see very, very clearly that he has no calluses, showing what a politician and a liar he is already.
Yeah, well, definitely, and this is all going to come into play heavily in the overall structure of the plot. So now Galadriel is, we get, we're privy to her audience with Miriel and Elendil, and she leads with, "The man in your cells is a king from the Southlands. He's not an ordinary man." And Miriel kind of quips, "Oh yeah, and Elendil is a runic emperor." And he's just like, "Well, actually, a petty lord," and he amuses himself. "Ha ha, I made a little joke," and then she gives him the stink eye. She's like, shut up.
She didn't love it.
Hey, I loved it, though.
I did, too.
His expression was great. So anyway, Galadriel's like, "Fight Sauron. Fight Sauron. Come to save the Southlands. You got to. You're noble. You're supposed to be noble." Muriel's like, "Nope, not going to do it. Southland, and the Southlander in my cell is going to face judgment whether he's a king or not." And then Galadriel, like, she goes a little Karen on him, and she's like, "I want to speak to the owner. I want to speak to Tar Palantir. I want to speak to your dad." And she's
and
like,
"Oh,
you know, I'm on a mission from the gods." So, and Muriel.
All she needs is some dark sunglasses and a fedora.
Yep. She's on a mission from God. She's one of the Blues Brothers. And Muriel throws her ass in jail for sedition, and Halbrand laughs his ass off at her when he sees her in jail, which is great. So now we cut to the sea, and Isildur's on one of the training vessels, and the sea captain is yelling, and they're going to be in the Navy in 2 days. So he's pretty proud of them. But then there's that ADD kicks in, that Western Shore ADD that Isildur, the kids today. You know, they're all in the meds, but Isildur's not. And he, all of a sudden, he hears his name, Isildur, from the Western Shore, and he fucks up. He doesn't ease the halyard proper.
Jude. He fucks up on purpose.
He does. And the sea captain's not having any of it, and he kicks him and his two buddies, Valandiel and Antamo, out. He kicks their ass out of the Navy. They ruin their career, and then they're outside. They're on land, and they are pissed.
They
at Isildur.
They're not happy about it.
Yeah. Especially Valendiel. Sorry. And he says, Valendiel just goes off like, "You don't deserve this. I've been working for this my whole life, and you just brood about your dead mother." And then that fucking sets off Isildur, throws hands right in the face, and then he's like, walks away, and Valendiel's like, "You ruined my life. Get the fuck out of here. I hate you."
So, at the same time, we first, I believe this is the first time we've heard that Isildur has a little shortened nickname of Isil. They just call him Isil.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Isil.
Izzy. He used to be when he was a kid. It was Izzy. So now this is like my favorite scene ever in almost in anything, I think. I love this scene because we're with Arondir in the orc, whatever, tunnel center. And they're having a ceremony, and there's an orc that is in tremendous pain, obviously going to die. He is wounded, and Adar is being summoned, and they're wearing these weird, like, ceremonial bird masks and that doesn't look like the thing that protects them from the sun. They're in the darker area now, and they're wearing these things. It looks more like ceremonial clothing. And Adar comes, and it's Cold Hands from Game of Thrones. He's like an elf, but he's got some scarification on his skin. He's gray and pale. And he starts speaking No. First he comes very, very caringly up to the suffering orc, and he puts his hand on the orc's head, and he eases his pain, and he's looking into his eyes, and it's like he's about to put Old Yeller down. You know, he really cares about this orc, and he's got a blade.
He's holding back tears. It looks like he's really holding back tears, which
he's gazing into the orc's soul.
And the orc, by the way, that's our friend Magrot. You know, Magrot. Let's give him a little respect, Magrot.
Magrot. So he's dying, and so Atos stabs him with the blade. He puts him down, and then the orcs say some words in the black tongue, some ceremonial thing, and there's reverence, and there's three dimensionality to our orcs.
This is the first time I think we've ever seen things like the idea that they have funerary services, and you know, they take off his armor in a certain way as though they're going to give it to someone, or like it's this whole process which we've never seen from them at all before.
Empathy and caring from their leader, who is like a father, truly. And he speaks in Quenyan to Arandir, which is the high elven tongue. And we see that Arandir picks up a sharp rock, and he's going to decide not to use this rock. And he asks Arandir where he was born, and he was born in Beleriand. And Adar talks about when he was younger, being by the banks of the river, and the river was covered in sage blossoms. And Arandir the acting in this scene is amazing. And
from both of them.
Yeah, and he seems like they're very calm, but like his energy is spent. Why did the orcs call you father? And he's sort of rolling his eyes, and then all of a sudden a warg just growls and howls right behind him. I don't know if Adar like actually gave off some weird vibes there or not, but Adar seems in himself calm. And he says, "You've been told many lies. Some run so deep, even the rocks and roots believe them." And that's awesome. And the creation of a whole new world would be required to fix it. That's how deep the lies are. The lies are so big to Adar. So to him, he doesn't think he's a villain. He thinks he's the good guy, and the world, shut your mouth. He's no god. He can't rebuild the world, but he wants to be. He says, at least not yet I am. I'm not a god. So I don't think this is Sauron. I don't think we're getting Sauron this season, but if this was Sauron, I would like it.
I think once again, they want us to think this. You know, I don't necessarily think it either, but I think they're setting up enough to give you these clues that, ooh, they're maybe, you know, they're just baiting those hooks and seeing who's going to bite.
Well, just by virtue of how stories are written, stories are told, and the popularity of keeping people in the dark and people loving conspiracy theories and trying to figure out who's who, they're not going to tell us right now. But this guy, if he was Sauron, it would make sense to me. He is a convincing force.
And he is clearly a three-dimensional character already, which is something that you and I had spoken about that we were hoping for from this show, and I think we're getting it, which is terrific. I'm very happy about that.
Right. That's exactly what I was looking for. And so Arandir asks, what are you? What are you? And he doesn't answer him. And he says he wants him to go to the old watchtower and deliver the men of the Southlands a message for him. So then we get to the watchtower, and Bronwyn is trying her best to decide how to feed everyone. And of course, we got asshole Waldreg And guess what asshole Waldrick is doing? He's being an asshole.
Oh, yeah, we'll get more to him later.
He's an ice hole. And he's not about cutting his rations. No, no, he's not going to cut him. And so Theo has a plan. And he's going to go to Waldrick's root cellar. And he's a very brave lad to get everybody food. He's tired of sitting there not doing nothing. And Bronwyn's like, no, you ain't going. But he don't listen.
Yeah, well, you know, they didn't have Game Boys back in Middle Earth, so he needs to do something.
Look, the boy needs an activity. I think dodging orcs is a good one for him. So he don't listen, and he gets that bitchy little Rowan who goes with him, which I'm surprised, because he is a bitchy little soft belly, Theo reminds him. But he does get a wheelbarrow full of food supplies. I don't know what's in there. Maybe some wheat. Fields of wheat.
As they're going down to finish gathering, we get a pretty good indication of the slaughtered animals that are just left rotting. Mm-hmm. All the livestock. It seems to be sort of this scorched earth policy for the orcs, which made me wonder. At first, I said, well, why not just burn the village? And then I realized, because during the daylight, that's where they're hiding, is in those houses and buildings. So it makes sense. But everything else is just destroyed.
You're right. Quite intentionally, almost assaulting the earth.
Yeah, like policy. A scorched earth. Yeah.
A black cloud descends, and Rowan, this freaks him out, and he just heads out. And Theo goes into the tavern to get some more supplies. And what do you think, scurrying around in that goddamn tavern? It's a fucking orc. I told you, don't go in the tavern. So you got the fucking orcs. And they get into a fight, and he gets stabbed by the orc. But it's not a mortal wound. And he uses that Sauron hilt he's got. And that thing flames on. And that's what they've been looking for. So the orc's like, oh my God, this is the thing we've all been looking for.
Yeah, his eyes just light up like he was Hello Kitty.
Yep. And so Mr. Theo ends up hiding in a well. He goes underwater. Of course, you know, the orc drops a bucket on his head, and he's like, oh, I'm down here in the well. And the orc looks for like 2 seconds while Theo's under the water. And then just is like, ah, fuck it, he's not down there. Yeah. I mean, the sunlight must have affected him, right, Jude?
Yeah, you know, I mean, he should have been wearing sunglasses. What are you going to do? That being said, I love the design of these orcs at this point also. Yep.
The helmets. Know,
yes, it harkens back to some old art that we've seen in some of the books and, you know, supplemental materials, as well as some of the animated stuff, and just bringing it together and realizing it the way they did on screen, because it's kind of goofy, but kind of awesome at the same time.
Yeah, awesome. And, where there's a whip, there's a way. If they started singing that, I wouldn't be surprised.
And I would love it. I would love it.
So,
But by the way, the design, one real quick interesting point is that, you know, those spiked helmets also harken back to German army helmets during like World War I,
yep,
which was something that Tolkien was involved in and affected him. So I think that's kind of intentional as well, you know, to keep in mind.
All right. The Battle of the Somme. So yep. That's what he was involved in. Elrond now, we're in Region, and Elrond is talking to, I think it's Punky Brewster's father. No, it's not. It's Celebrimbor.
Yeah, same difference.
I can't tell those two apart. So anyway, they're looking at the forged tower that's being built. And dwarves and elves working together. It's awesome. And Celebrimbor he looks at Elrond and he sees Eärendil, Elrond's father, in Elrond, and he said that Eärendil said to him, someday Celebrimbor's future will be in Elrond's hands. So they keep on talking, and through the course of the conversation, Celebrimbor brings up that Doran is avoiding him, and, or he's hiding something. So this leads Elrond to Khazad Dûm. And Elrond, here we find him talking to Deesa because Doran is not there. And he's trying to find out where he is, and she's lying her ass off. She's doing a great job of it, and Deesa is going to steal this episode in certain ways. But he's mining in the quartz chasm. And wise, but it doesn't seem like he's got his stuff. And she's like, nah, he's using the other stuff. He's prying. She's like, oh, that's some pretty strong gravy. Elrond, you coming in here and tell me I'm a liar. And she explains everything. And she's super smooth. It's not going to take him days like it would take an elf like you. Because he's a dwarf. And he can get down there in hours instead of days. And she explains everything pretty well. And then
she's a good liar.
She's great, but not great enough to fool Mr. Elrond. He's check out the big brain on Elrond. Doran is now talking to Deesa, and he thinks she's very clever, and also she's very sexy. He's going to sex her up some later. He's going to show her, and he's glad he married her, not that other dwarf. But yeah. Elrond is watching from afar, and you know, Elrond can read lips. And he says, the old mine below the Miramir. So that is where Durin's been going. So Elrond goes to the old mine, and he's figured out Durin's password because his kids were saying it in the background. So he just figured it out. Rich crone, kiss the stone, polish your gems and gold. He gives a little knick-knack paddywhack on the wall of the cave, and it opens up. And he's in the mine, and he confronts Doran. Doran's like, I knew it, you sent a spy. And he's like, I don't need a spy to find you, you schmuck. Right? And so Doran thinks he was sent by Gil-galad for his secret. And he got a little golem-like. Did you find him to be a little golem-like there, Jude?
A little bit. You know, a couple things. I want to roll it back a little bit there, though. I think that going back to the last couple of scenes that we steamrolled through right there, the writing, the dialogue in this episode has been terrific. When Celebrimbor is speaking to Elrond, and he says about his father mentioning that his son would what was it again? Save him or help him, but then he goes on to say that he said it quite casually, as if one might speak of tomorrow's rain, which I feel that these little lines thrown in are very Tolkien-esque. Those are the kind of things that he would use, these kind of little examples, and I think that's being handled really terrific. And then the dialogue between Deesa and Elrond, like you said, was extremely strong, and oh my god, you know, the actress, Sophia Namvedi, I believe, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correct, but she is just killer. She is stealing every scene that she's in, and we're lucky that we have someone like Owain Arthur, who's playing Prince Durin, because he's one of the few people, I think, that is really holding up to her in terms of just the acting and the personality that's coming across the screen right now. So,
awesome. And the acting in the whole show is great. We'll get to a little bit more detail with that at the end after we go through all the scenes of the show. So Doran now makes Elrond take an oath. He makes him swear on the stone wall, and he swears on Erendil's memory, his father's memory. And so only after he swears does Doran show him the Mithril. which he doesn't call me Thrill. It's this new or. Of course, we all know it at this point, but in case you don't know it, it's super light. It's super strong. It shines with an inner light. And the dwarves have a great name for it. They call it gray glitter. Ugh, it sounds like something that you have to buy your fucking kindergartner on the first week of school. Mrs. White said we had to get gray glitter. We need gray glitter for our project. But the elves call it mithril, and that's much better.
It's pretty much the translation of that, it seems.
Yeah, that's the translation, but it's much better.
It's just a prettier sounding name.
Yeah, and so why the big secret? Elrond asks, and he says it's because it's perilous to mine it. And his father restricted how much mining can be going on, like, severely. And then they talk about being friends, because it's all about the friends. And very friendly friends.
And during this, Durin also explains how they found it in the first place, which was Deesa, yes, detected it during a round of gold seaming, which apparently is how the dwarves sing to find things in the mountain and communicate with the rocks and what have you.
We're going to hear that later. And so there's a cave-in. Oh, no. And it traps four dwarves. Four dwarves are trapped. So
it would have been five of them had Elrond not kept Durin busy at that particular time.
Yep, as Deesa will point out. So now we cut to Numenor and Eärien. She's got to clean the floors and the goblets, Eärien. Apparently she's being trained by Mr. Miyagi. And Kemen is going to be very clever. He's going to ask her to dinner, because he's going to volunteer to help her out. And he makes a little joke. She's like, I don't like strange young men. I don't let them take me out. And she's like, okay, if I see any, you'll be the first to know. I made a little joke.
He is trying to charm his way right into her tunic.
That's right. So now we cut to jail, and Galadriel is being schooled by Halbrand just on how to manipulate people, basically. By using their fear. So he's like, you know, you gallop like a horse right into every situation. She's like, what, you're going to tell me about the art of war? And he's like, no, I'm going to tell you about how to fucking get what you want out of people. Because I'm not Sauron. He's not.
No, definitely not.
So he's like, if you can find their fear and then tell them how to master it, then you can master them. And they talk, and he finds what the queen is afraid of by talking Galadriel through it. And what is she afraid of, Jude?
She is afraid of these visions that she's been seeing of this prophecy coming to pass.
Well, yes, but she's mostly afraid. The reason why she threw Galadriel in jail was because she's afraid of Galadriel speaking to her father. She really doesn't want Galadriel going anywhere near her father for whatever reason. It has to do with the prophecy, but it also has to do with the fact that he's basically in a coma, and she doesn't want anybody to know that. Then the Farazone comes with the guards, and he's shipping her out, and he says it's under orders of the queen. And they open the gate, and she, of course, does what Galadriel does best. She kicks the ass. She kicks the guard's ass. Oh, and yeah. Farazan's about to go for his sword. And, you know, Halbrand's
like, buddy, don't do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that if I was you.
It's like, you know, it's almost like he's whispering in his ear. It's weird.
And he's also like, you know where she's going to go. She doesn't bullshit. She's just straight to where she's going to go. She's going to go where she wants to go, which is to see the king in the tower. So just meet her there. So now we're back to Isildur, and he's talking to his sister, Eärien. And she had to dinner. Jude, she had to dinner.
Yeah, she did.
She met, and he's like, oh, yeah, who is he? But he's got some bigger news. He fucked up again. He fucked up. She's like, well, you did it. Now you can go west. Just like you wanted. You got what you wanted. And he's like, well, I ruined my friends' lives. And I trashed our family name. And Dad won't lend me the horse. It's awesome. It's a 69 Mustang. So he can't go west anyway. And then all of a sudden people start calling the elf. She's escaped. The elf has escaped. And so now, of course, we hear a crash. We're in Tar Palantir's chamber.
And just a quick little point out there. During that scene between Isildur and Arrhenion? I am not pronouncing
it. Eärendil.
Eärendil. Anyway, between that, there's a really interesting visual cue behind them, which is it appears to be a contingent of men and elves fighting some sort of a sea monster or sea dragon together. You know, I don't know that necessarily means much beyond the fact that where they're at, they are still in reverence of that union between men and elves, which, you know, I found to be something worth taking a look at.
Good point. It's like that puppet show. So they're
a lot like that.
Maybe they're in the western part. But now we're in Tar Palantir's chamber. Galadriel breaks in through the window. He's kind of in like a coma-like state. He's kind of mumbling and he's coughing. He's like, Muriel, Muriel. He's mostly dead.
Yeah, he's basically in a hospice.
I said mostly dead. So
you will be soon.
He needs Miracle Max is going to show up, Jude. Didn't you know Miracle Max is from Tolkien's world? So very few know that he's in a coma. He's in a coma-like state. Very few know this. And Muriel tells her, because Muriel's there, because they knew where she was going, because she's Galadriel. And she doesn't telegraph. She telegraphs everything. So Muriel's there. There's a garrison waiting outside to lock her up and take her away. And Galadriel's like, come on. Can we be real, bitch? Can we be real? Why are you so anti-elf? What did we do? We helped you out. We gave you, you fought with us and we gave you all our secrets. And, your dad was cool. Your dad was cool. He was repentant. What happened to you? What happened to you? And Muriel explains that when she took the throne, she needed to keep the peace. And when she needed to keep the peace, she really needed to be sort of anti-elf to keep. There was a mass rebellion against her father. And so she was trying to, he was, the reason why there's a mass rebellion against her father was because he was trying to renew relations with the elves. So, she's got a kingdom to run. And they go into the other room and she shows her the actual Palantir, the Seeing Stone. And I love the way this was presented too, by the way. We can talk about this at the end of the show. So Galadriel's like, girl, come on. I know how to work some Palantir. You know, she's been around the block, Galadriel. She is not young. And Muriel's like, not this one, though. This one's a doozy. Wait till you see it. And Galadriel puts her hands on it, and there's like a cracking inside of it. It's amazing. And so the Palantir, you're not just getting a vision in this show. You're in the scene when you put your hands on that thing. You're right there. And there's a tidal wave a-coming, and it's crashing right through Galadriel. And Galadriel lets go of the stone finally, and she's, like, lost her breath. And you can tell she's been around the block, but this was something else. And Galadriel's like, well, the Palantir could be deceptive. It could be telling you, things that might not happen. And Muriel's like, nah, the problem is, It's already started to happen. You're at the beginning of this. When you show up is when this vision begins. And so Muriel's like, I have to watch my ass now or else Numenor is going to be destroyed. And Galadriel thinks the opposite is true. She's like, you have to actually be repentant support the elves, and the gods will reward you the way they did to for Numenoreans in the past. And if you don't support us, that's what's going to bring upon this wrath. And she says, evil is rising, basically, and we'll take over Middle-earth if you don't help stop it now. So be like a good Numenorean, like your ancestors. Listen to the faith. And she says, listen to the faith and help out the elves and go to the Southland and help us fight. But so Muriel says, faith may bind one heart, Galadriel, but it is too fine a thread to bind a kingdom. I'm sorry. So no go.
And she also says, I will not second guess the gods, which because she seems to feel that she has interpreted what they've said already, and it's set in her way. But that is a little bit, I feel, of foreshadowing for the end of the episode, and we'll get back to that when it comes around.
Right. So it's a battle in Muriel, just like it's sort of the same as the battle in Isildur, about between doing what you think might be the practical thing and getting along with the Numenorean anti-elf policy, or just joining the military, versus being faithful. So now we go back and, we're at the Watchtower, and Rowan comes back. He's got the wheelbarrow full of supplies. Everyone's like, oh, yeah, let's get that. And then where's Theo? Bromwyn worries, and Theo is still, we cut to the fucking well, he is still in that shit. It's dark outside. He must be cold.
Oh, he had to be down in that water, like, just peeing and doing God knows what else in there for hours, you know, and, figuring to himself, you know, hey, you know, let the orcs take a little taste of this. Of course, I feel they probably would have liked it, but that's a whole nother issue.
And we're going to see coming up pretty soon, we have a new sponsor who's going to be sponsoring the show, and that's going to have to do with the orc water. So anyway, we're back to the show. Every single orc is looking for that hilt. They want that Sauron hilt thing. And Theo does try. He gets out of the well and he tries running, and he's running around and he's sneaking, and the orcs are searching for him. And he, when you'd think he might get away, he gets grabbed. And
by the same orc that had him before.
Yep. And he's, I think the orc's about to cut off his arm.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, from behind,
who comes to the rescue?
It's Adarondir. He stabs him, and he's saving Theo, and they're running through the woods now, and orcs are in hot pursuit everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, he stabs him. He not only stabs him, he then swipes at his neck and nearly takes his head off, which after last episode, I was not expecting to see his head half hanging off of his shoulders the way we saw it.
It's pretty arbitrary. We're going to see what a warg is doing later. But anyway, they're shooting arrows. They're running through the woods. Arondir is Legolasing all over the place.
Arondir. You see what I did there?
That was good there. Jude is remedial. So then Bronwyn is there. She came there. And they make it out to the clearing eventually. And the sun is rising and the angels are singing. And the orcs can't follow them into the light. No. They can't deal with that shit. And in the background, we hear this soulful wailing out. And it's going to lead us into the next scene. And Deesa's in the cave and she's doing a ceremony. And it's like, ooh. And the male...
Only better.
Yeah, much better than that. And the male dwarves are like... They're doing their low dwarf thing, and they're having this big ceremony. And what's it for, Jude? What are they doing?
They are singing to the mountains.
That's right.
They're singing to the mountains, asking the rocks for help. And apparently they have, once again, a relationship with the actual stone and perhaps metal in the mountains that that other beings can't understand.
As a matter of fact, Elrond is there, and he can literally see the rocks responding to the song. I think he's pretty impressed.
And that is hearkening back to our opening title sequence. You know, it's the first glimpse we've gotten of that. That it almost feels like that's what's going on when we're getting our titles.
Yep. So Elrond is now talking to Deesa, and she is apologizing to him. She's thanking him for saving Durin, because if it wasn't for him, Durin would have still been in that mine. And Elrond forgives her for lying to him. Because she was defending her husband, and he respects that. And he's like, you're Doran's my friend, and it's fine. And Durin shows up, and he had pulled all four out alive. They all made it, but his father has shut down the whole goddamn vein. He's shut down.
And is he happy about it?
No, Durin expresses some daddy issues. He's got the daddy issues. He'll never trade words with the old goat again. He's pissed off, and then, you know, he's just going off about him. And then Elrond's like, "Dude, hold my beer, all right? You want to see your dad? My father single-handedly sailed to Valinor and got the Valar to vanquish Morgoth." Okay, and then
he's
the gods.
Pretty great dad.
That's how am I gonna compete with that? And then the gods put him in the sky to carry the evening star. So I've got to live up to that shit. All right, so shut up. So that's my daddy issue. He's in the fucking sky. The gods love him. But
my dad's the best, and I got to deal with that. Oh,
but if I could just talk to him one more time. Just one more time. So listen, don't waste your time. Because don't waste your time being mad at your dad. Just love the time that you got together. God damn it, we are friendly friends. Love your dad.
After that...
Deesa gives a little... You know what Deesa did?
Yeah, she's asking a... She's breaking the tension there, asking to tell this story about how they met.
Mm-hmm. A little comedy, the Hill Trolls story, who saved who.
Well, and their banter is very fun back and forth.
It is fun. I thought it was a child. His little bitchy cries. He was crying like a child. And I came there with my bow, and he's like, it was a sword. And he's like, whatever. So anyway, Durin the fourth faces Durin the third. The son faces the father.
Let me ask you this. When he first enters and he's calling to his father, and his father doesn't respond, and we see a shot of Durin the third almost completely still, like, I had a certain thought. I'm curious if you had the same.
That maybe he's in Durin the fourth's mind.
No, I was thinking that. I was thinking that.
Did I watch too much Mr. Robot?
A little bit. No, I was thinking that Durin the third might have been dead by then, and that, you know, he was going to have to deal with that. But it turned out not to be the case. But I kind of felt that for a minute in that scene.
So. Durin the third tells Durin the fourth that when a dwarf becomes a king, all of his forebearers flow through him. They share everything through him, their victories and their regrets and anger. And yeah, it's starting to sound dirty to you.
Starting to sound gross, yeah.
Because everything looks like a nail to a hammer. But
So wait, which am I? Am I the nail or the hammer?
The hammer, because everything is...
Okay, because I'm fine either way.
So what he tells him is, you'll always have me here, son. And he assures him that...
Durin's like, oh, great.
He don't ask for forgiveness. I You don't need to ask. I forgive you. You don't need forgiveness. You didn't do anything wrong. And I'm here for you. You're my son. I love you, son. And eventually he asks him, what is his intuition telling him about all this fucking elf business? And maybe he should go with Elrond to Lindon, and Doran agrees, because he thinks there's more to all this stuff with
the
elves.
Not really sure what it is, but yeah, he's like, there's something up.
Something's up. I don't think the elves know what's really up. Anyway, we go back, and Bronwyn is with Arondir, and he's got a message. The people of the south have to swear fealty to the enemy. Well, this is Adar talking. Or he's coming for Osterith, which is the tower that they're staying in. So they either have to swear fealty, or I guess they're going to be servants somehow anyway. So better off swearing fealty. They got to bend the knee, or else they got to fight.
And they're not going to win that fight, at least not right now, not with what they have.
No, but we know someone's coming with some help. So now in the same shot, we go to down the road a little bit, and asshole Waldrig is, he's being an asshole. He throws a flask of liquor to
a child.
Hey, Theo, you have a hit of this. It's non-addictive, and it'll put some hair on your chest.
I mean, look, let's be honest about this. Let's just get it right out in the open. The only thing that Waldrig is missing in this scene is a windowless white van with a badly written sign that says free candy on it.
Well, he knows about the hilt. Because Theo stole it from his goddamn tavern. And he shows Theo that he has the same mark on his arm from that hilt. And he says,
scars, yeah.
Right, it's not a sword. It's a power made for our ancestors by his master, his master's own hand. And the master was a beautiful servant. Of course, he's talking about Sauron. He was lost, but he shall return. And he asks Theo, have you ever heard of Sauron? And Theo's like, Sauron Levinson?
Yeah, he's like, hey, have you ever seen Gladiator movies?
He's like, no, just regular old Sauron. And then he said, have you ever spent time in
Turkish bathhouses?
A Turkish prison? All you airplane fans out there. So, and he asks Theo, did you see that falling star a couple of weeks ago? That's the sign. Sauron's coming. You better get ready. Save up your strength. You're going to need it. Blobity blanth. Sauron Claus is coming to Middle Earth. Anyway.
And incidentally, that weird metal neck brace thing that Waldrig's wearing, again, it just doesn't make the whole pervert bit look any better. Like, it's, oh god, that guy.
I think Waltrick's got other things on his mind, Jude.
I'm feeling he's got two things. Number one is Sauron, and number two, not going to go into detail, but I don't trust the guy.
So anyway, we cut to a warg eating an arm. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a nice...
That's fun.
This is a family massacre show. This is a family wog massacre show. We don't show sex. We don't show any of bodily parts, but we do show wargs eating arms. And so we're hanging...
It's warg food.
Look, it was Adar just hanging out watching his warg eating arm. It seems like
he was probably the one who gave it to him, you know? He went down to the local market, got a couple arms, threw them to the warg. It's what you do. You got to take care of your pets.
Mm.
Come on, you're a dog owner, you know that.
They have them in the back in case you are looking for it. Just human arm. If you go to PetSmart, it's in the back on the right-hand side, right where they have the little, doggy hotel. So back in Numenor, Galadriel, she is very publicly being shipped. Not shipped with a Halbrand. I told a joke. That was stupid. All right, she's being shipped away, actually physically brought to a ship, and she's standing there, and she's staring down the queen, Muriel. She's just staring down. But Farazan is very happy with the decision. He thinks the people are going to be behind it. Good political move. But then all of a sudden, as Farazan and Muriel are walking away, Nimloth just starts just shedding leaves like crazy. And Muriel changes her mind. She thinks about being faithful. She thinks about what she said earlier. About
signs from the gods.
Right, to Elendil when they were looking at the tree.
This was like a clear sign from the Valar that she was unable to ignore.
She was making a boo-boo, and now she got to fix it. So she gives an inspiring speech to the crowd that is gathered, and she talks about how they have to be faithful in the hour of need. It's the destiny of men. And Tar Palantir, he awakes, seems to awake a bit from his coma, opens his eyes, and she says that she's personally, the queen is personally going to go with the elf, with Galadriel, to fight the enemy in the Southlands, and Elendil needs an expeditionary force to go and defend his queen. And who is willing to go? Well, it's Isildur and his friends are the first to say, I will serve and volunteer. And we hear all of a sudden more and more people, and everyone is behind the queen to redeem Numenor in a sense and be, I don't know if it's necessarily faithful once more, but they're going to be fighting the enemy in the Southlands. They're going with their queen, and we hear the Numenor theme, and that really put me in my feels, Jude, when I heard that. I said over in the deep dive, I hadn't gotten something like the music, the theme for the ring, really, like, you know, yeah, did something, and this really did it for me, the Numenorian theme at the end, building up. It was very strong, and that's what the entire episode there. So, Jude, you got some things you want to throw in?
Yeah, well, let's walk back from the back. First of all, I think when Isildur and his friends do volunteer, once Isildur volunteers, there's a interesting look from Elendil to his son, and it was very difficult. I don't know if you have an opinion, but I couldn't quite tell if it was restrained pride or disapproval at this point. Like, I'm not really sure where that was going. It was kind of ambiguous, but it was very deliberate.
I think it was pride.
I'd like to think that as well. It was just, again, it was a little bit, again, uncertain.
It's a win-win.
Yeah.
He gets to be honorable, defend his queen, and stay faithful to the elves and Valar. So it's sort of a win-win for him and sort of his friends too. And you know, the gods have a funny way of working things. So
they do.
And you know that Elendil believes in that.
Yes.
The petty lord. He's a petty lord.
Just a once petty. Again that. That was a terrific bit of his personality that we're not getting a whole lot of right now.
The best part of it for me was how his smile faded when Muriel looked at him.
That dirty look.
That was really well played comedy right there.
Yeah, she's like, don't make jokes.
he was great. What else?
I think a couple things having to do with Halbrand. When he is in jail with Galadriel, he's the first person to actually directly call her out on how abrasive she's been since getting to Numenor. And, you know, I'm not sure if his calling her out is going to change her at all with that, or if she's going to continue to be kind of abrasive, but it feels like it, that little bit may have gotten to her, you know, like something for her to think about, which I kind of appreciated, because a lot of people, both online and in the show, have been calling her out on that.
Zero filter.
Yeah.
Zero filter on Galadriel, no strategy whatsoever. She just is like a bull in a china shop.
But, you know, that being said, Halbrand, I don't know if you noticed this, but during Muriel's speech at the very end, one of the last shots, we actually see Halbrand on one of the walls looking out and walking as a free man in Numenor. And she had said early on that he would face judgment, and he almost seems to have been absolved, maybe spoken his way out, perhaps to Pharazôn, after that little incident in the cell with Galadriel, which I kind of find interesting and would like to see where that goes and if there's any more of this interaction with Pharazôn and Halbrand.
Right, and that's particularly interesting if you're a Sauron is Halbrand theorist, because
exactly.
There you go. But I think you're right. This is his first real interaction just straight up with Pharazôn, and he proved to be very effective. So good on Halbrand, but maybe foreshadowing. What else you got?
A couple of one or two quick little bits. When Galadriel is walking with Muriel, I believe it's to the Palantir, there's a quick shot of her, and she walks by a sword. And when you look closely at the sword, the hilt and pommel design is not identical, but very close to what we see in the Peter Jackson films of Narsil. And I think that that classical Numenorean design will still come into play. And I think whenever we do finally see Narsil, I believe that it will be very close to at least the film versions of it, on what we've seen, what we saw in that one shot of Galadriel. I feel that's a little bit of an Easter egg there.
So was Narsil definitely forged in this period?
Yes. I believe it was forged before this, although with time compression, who knows, like they could play with it. But I believe it is a family heirloom of Isildur's that was passed down to him. And then obviously, you know, it'll shatter, et cetera, et cetera. But I think whenever we see it, though, we're going to have that iconography, which we are not sure of right now.
So no Mithril in Narsil?
I do not believe there should be. It wouldn't shatter if that were the case.
True. But it shattered on Sauron.
Yes.
Sauron could do that to things.
Well, you know, I mean, it's possible, but regardless, it in theory should have been forged before the finding of Mithril, I believe. Well, again, the book to show is, you know, we have to understand that we're playing with some of these timelines a little bit, and just, it is what it is. We'll see how the writers of the show interpret it.
So how do you relate the falling star, the meteor, to what Waldrick said?
My thoughts are that he is looking for signs, and whether or not the actual falling star has anything to do with some of these signs, someone who's looking for signs has what you'd call confirmation bias. So they're just going to interpret these as meaning something to them. And I kind of feel that's what's going on.
No.
Not that there's not a relationship, but I don't believe...
I don't agree with that. Okay. I don't agree with that. I think this was prophecy, part of the lore from the followers of Sauron, And I don't think it means that that is Sauron. I think that's a blue wizard, or hopefully, or maybe, you know, we said a Lorien, Gandalf's Maya name. But I think it's come down at this point in time because Sauron's emerging, not the other way around. But
no, fair enough.
But it is a portend for the people of the Southlands.
Fair enough. I can agree with that, yeah.
So, what did you think of Adar's... you were possibly thinking that he was one of the original corruptions of Morgoth. Maybe he was an early attempt?
Yeah. That's I'm still kind of thinking that. That's because again, I do not necessarily believe that he's Sauron. Once again, if he was, you know, it could work, but I don't think that's the case. So because of what he talks about and having been in Beleriand, you know, as a child and presumably born there. That wouldn't be Sauron. Sauron came before that. He came before the elves. So, as one of the Maiar. So, you know, I do think still that he is more than likely perhaps a corrupted elf who then was, you know, a proto-orc or something to that effect and, helped create the race perhaps with Morgoth and Sauron, and follows that...
Maybe he just spent enough time with either Sauron or Morgoth to be fully invested, a true believer in their point of view, and that's why he is so adamant that the world that is supposedly good is a big lie. Maybe he's just so well indoctrinated in that he can't get out of that mindset. And for him, the villains are the good. Now
yes, it's like a cult mentality,
right? Now either that, or I mean, could he possibly be Sauron? I think so, only because
possible.
I was thinking, would a changeling have a scar? Wouldn't a changeling be fair? But then again, if he's a very manipulative presence, maybe he wants the orcs to see him as one of them, as their father. I think in this episode, I think he's actually acts like the most benevolent father figure in this episode, even though Doran the Third is very forgiving and loving to his son. The performance given by Adar seemed to reach a height of empathy that was, well, at the very least rivaled that of Doran's for Doran. And I think that's an interesting factor. Muriel and her father have this interesting relationship. Elrond speaks.
Isildur and his father.
Isildur and his father. Elrond and Eärendil. Mm-hmm. All these relationships came into play in this. And also, of course, Punky Brewster and her father, Celebrimbor.
And there's also...
You still feeling that way? You still feel he's the guy. The guy's a good actor.
Oh yeah, no. Again, it's he's a good actor.
Punky
Celebrimbor, but Punky. You know the look is just a little off. But no. What I was about to say was we have Kemen. I want to say Kevin. Kemen and Farazan. Their relationship as well. It's again all about fathers. This whole
right, and Farazan is trying to school his son, So all the fathers are doing their, seemingly doing their best, but all leading their children in different directions. So with that, Jude, do you have anything last that you want to add?
No, I think we've analyzed this episode pretty well.
All right. And hopefully Rowan will be with us next time, now that he's gotten his stuff back in his apartment, and very little stuff, like I said. So he should be with us. We did have his notes this time, and we thank him for that. And great episode. I had a lot of fun talking about it tonight. And I am Rob Law, and this is the J.R.R. You Talkin' to Me podcast. And Jude Fox, you got something to take us out with?
I do, Rob. Thank you very much. I just want to remind all of our listeners to like, subscribe, give us 5-star ratings on all of your podcast apps. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can email us at youtalkingtome@gmail.com. And find us also on our Facebook group, You Talking to Me About the Fellowship. So please share with your friends and help grow the fellowship.